Yeah, you don't need a massive reception and with beautiful coffee tables and design books and flowers and stuff everywhere. Really, you just need great designers. And I think the pandemic brought that into sharper focus, I think.
What kinds of cardboard boxes?
What's in the box?
What's in the box?
It loses its value if you take it out of the package.
Hey, PDU crew, it's Evelio Montes on Package Design Unboxed. I'm super excited to tell you that I've partnered with Pentawards. They're one of the most prestigious packaging design competitions in the world. Now, what we're going to be doing is bringing you a ton of creative content around packaging design. Today's episode is with Asa Cook. He's a creative director of Intertype Studio out of London. And we're going to get into a ton of things in terms of conversation, but you're going to walk away with a lot of great little nuggets and ways to apply strategic thinking to your packaging design. One of the things that we will get into is how Asa launched Intertype Studio just before the pandemic and the panic that sets in, the process you go through in terms of like launching a studio, not just at during any time, but in the middle of a crisis, and how he lands his first clients and, you know, some tips in terms of launching an agency and what you need to be doing. We also get into the studio and not necessarily the style that the studio delivers, but the process they use to deliver solutions. And you're going to find out from Asa just the amount of strategy that goes into any design. He does something really cool that I haven't seen anybody else do, which was codify their process and codify the input before turning to design. So that was something really interesting I learned from him that I haven't heard from anybody else, and something that I'd never applied in my process, but I'm definitely going to start applying to it today. All right, so listen to today's episode, and if you love it, if you enjoy it, if you get anything out of it, please do me a favor, rate, review the podcast, wherever it is that you're listening to podcasts, and definitely share the podcast with anybody that you know that's in packaging design. I'm doing everything I can to grow this podcast. I'm bringing on great guests, and if you've got questions that you'd love to hear from some of these guests, please leave it in the comments, either on my LinkedIn, on Twitter, find me. Well, you know what? Don't find me on Twitter because my Twitter has turned completely into an NFT crypto Twitter space. It has nothing to do with packaging anymore. So definitely find me on LinkedIn because that's where I'm at. And again, this is in partnership with Pentawards. Go on pentawards.com, submit your packaging design artwork. We'd love to see it. So thanks so much, guys. Let's jump right into the show. All right, so we got Asa Cook from Intertype Studio on the podcast today. Asa, thank you so much for joining us. I'd love to hear about who you are and what Intertype Studio does.
Well, thanks for having me. So Intertype Studio, we call ourselves a strategic brand design agency. Obviously, we've done a lot of entries into the Pentawards, so we have an emphasis on branded packaging. But really, we think about brands holistically. So we're often asked to work on things like wider touch points like comms or websites or environmental designs and the brand world of brands generally.
Wow. And how do you arrive at packaging and branding? What led you in that direction in the first place? You know, what were you studying in school? What made you decide that packaging and branding was what you wanted to do?
Well, funnily enough, when I was at university, I studied graphic design. And I always used to end up doing projects where I made physical objects. I remember there was a guy that worked in the kind of print studio that helped you with the practical side of things, whether it was letterpress or screen printing and mock-up making. And I was always sitting in his room for hours making things. So if I was asked to design a piece of print, I'd end up making it into a game and it'd be in a physical box. And, you know, I was obsessed with the kind of physical finish and appearance of things. And he said to me one day, "Oh, you're going to be a packaging designer." And I was like, no way. No way, because I thought I was, you know, just a graphic designer, a conceptual designer, and I didn't really see myself as a packaging person. But then, lo and behold, when I graduated, you know, it was the packaging design agencies were the ones that were looking at my work because I had that kind of bias towards making things real, I guess.
So a big part of your design, as I go through your website, intertypestudio.com, what I get from your style, you know, however many years from when you graduated, is there's a precision to the design. There's definitely a craft, whether it's in the print, in the type, in the form. There's just so many details to everything that you're creating. Like, how would you personally describe your style? Like, what is Asa's style? What are you known for?
I mean, I always just believe in brilliant ideas which are beautifully executed. And the beautiful execution is just as important as the quality of the idea, but you can't have one without the other. So I, to be honest, I don't really consider myself to have a style at all. I don't have, you know, I don't work in a particular aesthetic. So for instance, if you look at our website, you can see we've got something that's inspired by mid-century America. And then we've got other stuff that's inspired by Art Deco and other stuff that's inspired by China and the Forbidden City in China. So those aesthetics are entirely different. So I wouldn't consider, I was working on something today, which is rooted in almost like, you know, cowboy culture and Texas and stuff like that. And it's a completely kind of new area, a new aesthetic for me. Wow. So I definitely don't consider us to have a visual style, but it's the philosophy and the approach that I think ties everything together. So we really believe in storytelling through design. And, I always say that, and I feel like I need to say, I don't mean that as a buzzword. I'm not just saying design is storytelling without actually meaning it or, you know, having any context to it. Because what I'm basically saying is that every detail, whether it's the finish, whether it's the typography, the choice of materials, the physical shape, all of those things tell an individual part of a story. And maybe that's what you're picking up when you look at our work, is that all the details add up to a bigger thing. So the first thing that we do is we work out what the bigger thing is. And then everything that we do tells the story.
You know, I'm looking at Tea House Gin for the Juniper and Oolong, which is a beautiful bottle. You've got some amazing line work happening in the glass as well as the label. And then just below that on your website, you've got the teal scrubs edition, right? Which is this Art Deco playing card set, but I can still see the connection between those two from, it's like this, there's a really preciseness to it. And it's just beautiful. And maybe it's just the colors that because those two are so close together visually on the website, they feel similar. But maybe as a designer, when you're looking through somebody's work, you start seeing pieces that start making a connection for you to tell you about this person's design style. So in terms of storytelling, you know, how do you arrive? Like, let's take a look at Tea House Gin. How did you arrive at this bottle shape? You know, what are you telling the consumer when they encounter that bottle, when they hold it?
So there's massive depth in Tea House Gin. And it's kind of a long story, but I'll try and tell it as briefly as I can. So I was lucky enough to visit China in October 2019. And this is where I met the client. But on the lead up to meeting the client, I was lucky enough to go to Beijing and go to the Forbidden City and go to the Great Wall of China. And I was just, I didn't know at that point that I was about to get a Chinese brand and a Chinese client. But I was really kind of just immersing myself in the culture. So I was visiting like the Shanghai Museum, for instance, and looking at, Qing Dynasty vases. And then I went to the Forbidden City and I saw a lot of amazing oil paintings. And you go to certain rooms and there's amazing clocks that were donated from different countries around the world. And I guess I didn't realize, but I was fermenting a lot of this information. And then when I suddenly got briefed on this Chinese project, all of those stories kind of came out. So with that project, you know, we were asked to kind of build the concept of the brand from the ground up. And I came up, because I'd just been to the Forbidden City, I came up with this concept. And I'd heard about this Chinese empress that had basically opened up the gates of the Forbidden City to the wider world for the first time. And it's just hit me that this was an analogy for what this brand was trying to do, because they had these kind of international values, but they were also aiming very much at kind of traditional Chinese tea drinking and Chinese culture. And so there was this collision of cultures. So the story of the Empress was the perfect metaphor for what the brand was doing. So that's why all of the elements of the design are inspired by stories of the Empress and of the Forbidden City. So I mentioned that I saw this exhibition of clocks and I was really struck by the fact that all of these foreign governments and foreign visiting kind of dignitaries were going and visiting China and then going to see the Empress and taking these amazing gifts. And I was kind of really interested in the collision of cultures that was happening. So if you think of gin is from London, basically. It's a British spirit, but this is a Chinese gin. So you've got the collision of those two cultures. So we basically imagined a meeting between the Empress and a visiting dignitary, and then him giving the gift of gin and her giving him a gift in exchange, because there was this kind of tradition mm-hmm. around the meeting of the two cultures. So, and we thought of a birdcage. So the whole structure of the bottle is inspired by a birdcage. That's why it's faceted with the vertical facets. So the, you know, the liquid represents the thing that came from England, and then the bottle that it comes in represents the cultural elements from China. So then when you look at every detail, you can see in all the detail that we've got this collision of kind of this London detailing and sensibility and typographic craft versus these Chinese traditional symbols and traditional Chinese shapes and characters and illustration style and that kind of thing. So to get to that point, we codified all those things. So we codified illustration, structure, textures, materials, typography, everything before we even did the design.
You said two things that I want to get into. One was you mentioned that you spent time going through these exhibitions and you were fermenting information. I've never heard anybody say that they've been fermenting information.
I don't know if I've even said that sentence before, but that's just how it came to my head.
I love it because it definitely draws a picture of what you're doing. And as a designer, you're taking all this, you're taking input from your everyday, and whether you're going out and seeking it or you're just experiencing it, and you just put it like in a bank, right? And it's going to come back for something else.
That's exactly it. I think that designers are basically walking storage facilities of visual stories, basically. So all the stuff that you're feeding your mind with, whether you go to the Tate or you go look in a design book or you go and visit a museum or a gallery and stuff, you don't know that it's going to be useful when you're doing it, but it is, and it comes back out, and your subconscious brings it back out, which is a similar story with what happens to the cards, by the way. It was completely designed by or dreamed up, literally dreamt, because I literally had a dream about it, where things collide in your mind, visual ideas collide in your mind, and then they come out as a finished idea.
Yeah, well, that's just it. It's like all these inputs, and they mesh together. When they come out, it's completely new, which I love. The other thing you mentioned was that you, for Tea House Gin, you codified the illustration. Mm-hmm. Okay, so explain to me, what does that mean?
What it means is that, like, if you go to, I went to the Summer Palace, which is basically a huge garden in Beijing, mm-hmm. and you see these pavilions, and there's the most amazing painting and illustration on the ceilings and on the walls of these pavilions. And they were like, you know, 200 years old or older. And I looked at them, and the colors were so vibrant, and they looked so fresh. They looked like they'd been drawn like a week. They looked like they'd been painted like a week ago. And I had a hard time believing that they were 200 years old. So what I mean is that we defined the whole concept of tea house gin being these reinvention of these traditions. So with every code of the design, so color, for instance, color is directly, in all of those designs, is directly derived from photos that I took inside the Summer Palace, inside the pavilions. But when you abstract those colors, because I was wondering, why does it look so modern? Why do those illustrations look like they were done yesterday, even though they weren't? And it's because the colors were so vibrant and modern, and the illustration was so simple and graphic and relevant now. It looked like it was very recent. So we were basically saying that the whole brand was about reinvention of tradition, because it's not traditional in China to make a gin, but tea is tea is traditional.
Yeah.
So you've got that tradition and that modernity coming together in one thing. So every code of that design is about that collision. So we broke down what that meant for illustration. So we took the images that I took inside the pavilion, and then abstracted the colors and said, look how modern these colors are, you know, and look how contemporary and vibrant this illustration could be and how modern and relevant it can be, even though it's based on a very traditional Chinese culture. Wow. That's what I mean about codifying. We broke down the reason why everything looks the way it looks.
Penswolds is celebrating our 16th annual competition. We have partnered with Package Design Unboxed to bring you exclusive content from our jury and previous winners. Our competition is currently open until the 1st of April. Penswolds would love to see your packaging designs. Submit them at penswolds.com.
Hey, I want to introduce you to idpdirect.com. We recently won a Silver Pen Awards for collaborating on the future of sustainable packaging. If you want to work directly with the packaging manufacturer and you're tired of distributors and middlemen, check them out. Visit idpdirect.com to learn more.
Okay. And when you're doing that, like, what does that look like in terms of workflow? Like, do you have actual board for color and for type?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that any brand is a combination of time, place, and attitude, or any one of those three things. So in other words, it has to be rooted in some time. The time could be now. It could be, like we were just saying, it could be Art Deco. It could be ancient China. It could be in Texas in 1950. Some of the stuff on our website is really inspired by the 50s. You know, it's 150 years later than the tea house inspiration, but it's still a particular time. And with that time comes a particular aesthetic. So if you work out the time that a brand is rooted in, it gives you the aesthetic. You know, and then you've got the, you know, the place, and then you've got the attitude. So, you know, you can be irreverent, or you can be, you know, fun and playful. So, you know, you look at what we did on National Bohemian Distillery, and it's kind of fun and playful. So you layer that attitude into the time, which is the mid-century, and it starts to design itself if you understand what you're trying to do.
So a time period means then looking at the colors that were used during that time in a particular
everything.
Aesthetic.
Typography, illustration, colors, materials, everything. Yeah.
So Intertype is hardware, right? It's a piece of equipment from a particular era that had particular type. How did that evolve?
Exactly the same reason. Yeah. So trying to find an analogy for what we do, which is, we're trying to create kind of disruption or revolution in the way that design works. And that's what the Intertype machine did. So, you know, everything letterpress used to be, I've got a letterpress poster behind me here. Mm-hmm. Letterpress used to be wooden blocks that you picked out by hand. And, you know, cause I did this at university. Yeah. I'm sure a lot of designers do. You lock it into place, you know, you find the components, you make this frame, and then you print it by hand. Then the Intertype machine came along. There was a competitor as well, the Linotype machine, which is the one that people have more commonly heard of. And it was basically like a huge typewriter. And when people wrote on the typewriter, so instead of a whole newspaper or a poster, instead of having to do it by hand, suddenly you typed on the machine, and then the blocks slid into place. They dropped down, and you could set huge, you know, pages and pages and pages of copy and print it like really quick. And it completely revolutionized the way that print worked and the way that design communication worked. And, you know, we're trying to suggest that that's what we're doing now. But I think the whole idea of having an analogy for what you stand for and what you're going to do and what you aim to do is very much rooted in the way that we design, you know, as you can hear, hopefully, when we talk about tea house or the playing cards or whatever.
I think that is the style. Right. You say you don't have a style, but I think there's a style. I'm going to, you know.
Well, it's an approach, right? It's a way of getting to a result. But what I like about it is that it's never going to get you to the same result twice.
Right. Yeah. It's extremely thought through, and there's a precision to that thinking. So it's almost this surgical precision for creating a brand and creating a pack, which is definitely not something you see a lot.
Yeah, I always say to people that having a process is really useful, right? Because being creative is really hard, isn't it? Because you're sitting there, you're trying to expect an idea to come to you. But if you have some sense of like what you think gets you to great design, there's no harm in having a kind of process, because as I said, what you'll get to is different every time. So I do sometimes say to people, you know, trust the process and trust, you know, working out who your audience is, what will appeal to them, what the story of your brand is, where it comes from, the time it's set. That's all just really useful, because anytime you're stuck, you can go back to that as a way to get to a great design.
Yeah, and so you do, so you also do not just packaging and branding, but you also do interiors and environments, right? So you've created some environments for Tea House as well.
We didn't build them, but we provide inspiration for how they should look.
Sure.
So yeah, we're not like we're not people that go and manufacture that stuff.
Right.
We do that for a lot of brands. So we're working for a big beauty brand based out of the US recently, and they wanted us to design their point of sale displays.
Yeah.
So we're literally physically designing and sketching and showing the materials, textures, colors, where the logo goes, how the stuff's displayed, etc. And then when it comes to something like Tea House Time, what we're doing is expressing those brand values that I just talked about the collision of cultures, reinventing traditions, breaking down the colors and saying, okay, this is how color shows up in environmental design. This is how materials and textures show up. And basically just guiding the whole aesthetic of the whole brand. We don't physically make it, but we kind of codify it.
You know, if you've got four main steps in this process, like what are they?
So I would say, the first thing is the story of the brand and how that breaks down into the time, place, and attitude of the brand, and then what falls out of that. So, and then you break that down into specific ingredients. So color, typography, iconography, illustration, photography, textured materials, form, you know, physical shape. You can work on all of those things. You think about all of those things, because all of those things need to be there for a reason. So I'm making it sound a little bit too process driven, I think.
It's not as scientific
as that. That is the kind of aim, because if you don't do the thinking, you need to do the thinking basically, as well as just the doing.
Yeah.
Because if you don't do thinking, nothing, it just won't be very valuable or useful. So all the great design agencies that I admire, you can feel that depth has gone into everything that they do. You know, I really don't like design that's just surface, that's just aesthetic, that's not actually building anything that's relevant when it comes to what the brand stands for or what the product is. You know, so I think you have to go through that rigor, otherwise what you're doing doesn't really have much meaning. And there's no reason to believe in it, right?
Yeah, and if I look at like the Natty Bow, did you guys come up with Natty Bow, or is that what it's referred as?
Natty Bow is, so they've made beer for a long time, and all the locals call it, it's called National Bohemian, but all the locals call it Natty Bow. And so the little character, his name is Natty Bow. But we kind of reinterpreted that as being like Natty in English means kind of smart or dashing, or which I don't think is why he was called that. But we kind of used that as a way to kind of dress him up and make him really kind of almost ironically sophisticated, and he's like this super premium kind of like concierge server type, butler type character.
There's a sensuality there in terms of packaging, and you know, and maybe it's just the way that I view packaging, where it's, you know, packaging is really, it's personal, you're interacting with it. I guess, how do you instill an emotion into packaging?
Well, I think the amazing thing about packaging is, I think it's the hardest thing to design in the world, by the way, because it requires so much, you know, technical knowledge, so much skill in typography, illustration, 3D design, like every type of skill is needed for it. But, you know, what I love about it is that it's engaging all of the senses. So unlike digital design, which can use like sound and vision, you know, with packaging design, you've got sound, because the sound it makes when you open it or whatever. You've got the way it looks, but you've also got the tactility of it. So it sort of engages, and even the scent of it, so it engages all of the five senses. So I'd say I'm really quite fascinated by the contrast in different materials, you know, always juxtaposing gloss finishes with really matte finishes, or, you know, embossed with smooth, or, and I think that really great packaging designers always consider that sensory experience. I think what you're describing is like the sensory experience of a physical thing. And I think it is really crucial as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. And then, so last year you took home 4 Penn Awards, which are, you know, wonderfully displayed behind you there, including Newcomer Award for the studio. So how does winning an award like a Penn Awards, how does that help a growing studio?
What it's done for us is really reassure our clients, because I think, you know, they'd already come to us or already working with us and obviously must have liked us. But I think it's a little bit of like, and a lot of them were like, you know, looking at the work that we're doing and going, really loving it, really loving what we're doing. And I think it just kind of like helps to confirm that in people's minds. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, because it's judged by really, you know, well-known people, really good high-level creative directors, you know, people that are very creatively involved in brands at a very high level, and they're your peers and they're saying, we think this works great. You know, it really helps, I think, to confirm that in everybody's mind. So we were really thrilled, you know, to get that honor. And it's been great to be able to display it on our website. It's on our email signature. Best Newcomer Agency, you know, added it to everything to kind of keep reinforcing that, you know, it's not just us that think we're good.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just, you know, and it's not just Best Newcomer in London, right? It's Best Newcomer just as an agency in this industry, which is amazing.
Yeah, we were really thrilled with it. Yeah, very pleased.
That's awesome. And you guys you're a newcomer because you've been in business for, you started about 2 years ago?
2 years, yeah.
Okay. So, you know, you were with an agency previously for like 17, 18 years, and you left to start an agency 2 years ago, which is 2020. You crack open the doors of this new agency and then the pandemic hits. Right. Yeah. So what happens? Like, what goes through your mind?
Well, first of all, I mean, I guess it was unlucky, but it was also lucky because we had, we were in conversation about a studio space, which, you know, was in the middle of Soho in London, and we were working out of that space, but we hadn't signed a lease yet, you know, so we hadn't committed to that. So obviously we had to start working like from home, like everybody else did, but actually, you know, versus massive established agencies who have these massive empty spaces and these big overheads, we were lucky because we were almost kind of formed during that time. So all of our ways of working, we didn't have to adapt. Like, we didn't have to stop doing something a certain way. We built our ways of working based on remote working. So in some ways, it felt like a kind of benefit. You know, very scary, obviously, when at first, because you're like, well, where's the work coming from? And like, are we going to get any work? And, you know, we had some quiet times at the beginning, which were a little bit scary, and which is why we did the card, playing card project, you know, because that was a self-initiated project. But yeah, it was obviously a massive step to take and challenging times to do it. But I think often in times of adversity and, you know, economic downturn and, you know, recession and stuff like that, a lot of new agencies are often born in those situations, and it creates a lot of opportunity, I think, because it like levels the playing field, you know, especially in this situation. When, if I was sitting in my living room talking to a global brand director, they didn't find that weird.
Right.
You know, whereas if I'd been doing that before the pandemic, they would. So it kind of made, I think people more than ever realized that when you buy into an agency, you're just buying into people, right? So it's people, their skill, their talent, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all you need.
It's not the beautiful office behind you in your Zoom call.
you don't need a massive reception and with beautiful coffee tables and design books and flowers and stuff everywhere. Really, you just need great designers. And I think the pandemic brought that into sharper focus, I think.
So how do you land, you know, how do you land that first client?
I would advise that if people are going to start an agency, that they have an idea of who their clients are going to be before it gets to that point. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, I was able to do that, to find new clients very early on. And then beyond that, I mean, a lot of people have said to me, like, where is the work coming from? Because I used to ask people at startup agencies that question a lot, like, how do you get the work? You know, and I just sort of didn't know where it comes from. But I think it's your whole portfolio, it's your whole history, right? It's your whole working career comes back to you. And when you start an agency, you know, it's amazing the number of people that contacted me through LinkedIn, who I'd used to work with a long time in the past. Right. And going back like a decade, you know, and people getting back in touch, and they want to support. And I wondered if that was another benefit of the pandemic as well, is people wanted to support a new business and a small business. And maybe people thought, you know, wow, this is a hard time to do it, so let's get involved. I don't know. I don't know if that was a benefit or not, but a lot of people got in touch, and really most of the work kind of has come to us, to be honest.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And the work that you guys are doing is so much fun. So are you working on anything currently that you're like really excited about? You mentioned a cowboy thing, you know, we can't get too into it, but you know.
I'm working on loads of things. There's a Texas thing that we're working on, which I love. There's a massive global brand, super premium brand that we're working on, which is an amazing client, and we're doing brilliant work for. I can't wait to share that, because I think, you know, being best newcomer and working on small projects like the gin or the playing cards is one thing, but when you start to work on like globally known brands, we can't wait to share that, because it's a bit of a, it's the next step, basically.
You found yourself using any like QR codes or augmented reality or any of those items that can seem kind of gimmicky, but I think people are starting to use?
I'd say that it's come up quite a lot in brand world conversations, what we can do with that kind of stuff. I mean, we in-house, we don't have the kind of skill set to do VR or that kind of stuff. But in the same way that I mentioned that, like when you build a brand and it's got a story behind it, and that story applies to everything from the identity, the typography, the colors, the, you know, the layout, the environmental design, it also applies to everything else. So, you know, with Tea House Time, for instance, we created these porcelain dogs, because the Empress always had her favorite animal was a dog. She had pets, these pet dogs around her all the time. So we were thinking about social media and the way that people want to share things, and, you know, what would get people using WeChat in China would be these opportunities to photograph these physical real things, and then they would then go into the digital space. So we are constantly thinking about the way that, you know, physical design becomes digital design and the crossover between the two, but we don't necessarily create apps or that kind of stuff ourselves, but we'll suggest ways, you know, people that brands can partner with to do that.
Yeah. That's always great to have that conversation with the brand. And as you're designing packaging, because you're taking so many inputs from everywhere else, you see an opportunity, maybe it's in an area that you're not proficient in, but just to be able to throw that idea out to the brand and then let them run with it and create something amazing.
Yeah. Literally just before this meeting, before this podcast, I was in a meeting with a client where we were talking about their website, you know, and they wanted our guidance on their website. I mean, we don't host and build websites, because especially not e-commerce ones, because we, you know, they require a lot of maintenance, you know, you need to, it's a specific skill set. You need a front end developer, a back end developer, you know, and what we can do is make that easy for a client, because if you've got the identity and the visuals and the photography and the look and feel of the whole brand, and you've got guidance on how your website should work and how it should look, that's the hard part. The hard part of any digital design is the content, you know, and then if they can take that palette and then they can go and work with a technical expert, then they've got something great, like fast, you know. So we've done it recently for something that I can talk about it now because it's just come out, but there's a sugar brand in the UK called Bonraw, and we've designed their pack and their whole brand and their whole brand identity and their whole brand world. But they've got a really big e-commerce website, which is hosted and run for them by somebody else. But we provided all of the digital assets, all the typography, all the photography, you know, everything, all the iconography, all the assets that they needed to create it, basically. So then the other company just inputs all that, you know, and makes it functional.
What's like the perfect Intertype Studio client? Like, who are you looking for and who should be reaching out to you?
I think anybody who wants to put a depth of meaning and quality and storytelling into their brand. People have said to us, a lot of what you do feels premium. I mean, the sugar product that we're working on, it's premium. It's a great quality product, but it's not a massively expensive purchase like the gin bottle is. So people sometimes say to me, oh, do you only do super premium stuff? We're like, no, we just do good stuff. So, you know, what we're looking for is quite broad, really. I mean, I do love working on drinks design and really premium spirits brands, because you've got all that opportunity to do all that tactile, sensorial stuff that we talked about. And there tends to be quite a lot of investment in design. So that's why working on that stuff is so great. But, you know, equally, you know, you can work on things that are more accessible and more approachable and more mass and, you know, less high cost of goods, but it's still, the design can be amazing still. I mean, the playing cards is a great example of that because it's just a box, right, with some cards in it, but it looks really super premium just because of the way it's executed.
The design can elevate that to be something that, you know, somebody may want to just keep on their counter.
Yeah, definitely. I think you can make anything. You can make anything desirable through design, 100%. I mean, you know, I think Aesop's a really good example of that. For instance, like soap, right?
Yeah.
Ultimately, so, you know, and soap is a commodity, really, technically, isn't it? But the design elevates it, right? So you can elevate anything. And I've always had this philosophy that any design project can win an award. You know, and you can make anything amazing. And so as soon as you start kind of thinking, well, oh, that's from this category or that's this, it's, you know, that's not going to be as good as other designs, then you kind of already lost, right? So we don't want to have too much of a narrow focus. We just want to do great design, basically.
That's awesome, man. So Asa, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you being on here. You've got amazing work. Congratulations on winning Best Newcomer. I look forward to seeing what you're going to win this year. Hopefully there's some cowboys in it.
Fingers crossed. You never know.
That's it for the show. Thanks so much for joining us on Package Design Unboxed. If you have any questions, you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm always available for questions. Once again, check us out at PackageDesignUnboxed.com.